Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You know, I grew up, you know, Milton Friedman was my mentor. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Wall Street Journal editorial page. Yeah. I have retained a healthy appreciation for free markets. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's useful to have a culture that counterbalances some of that.
This is Free Exchange from CapEx. I'm Oliver Wiseman, CapEx's editor.
My guest for the first in a new run of Free Exchange episodes is New York Times columnist and best-selling author David Brooks. His previous books include The Road to Character, The Social Animal, and Bobos in Paradise. Most recently, he is the author of The Second Mountain. It's a book that deals with a bigger question than the issues we usually worry about here at CapEx. What does it mean to live a good life? Now, that's a personal question, and The Second Mountain is a very personal book, but it's not without political implications. Brooks is critical of meritocracy. He cites grim statistics about deaths of despair and loneliness in America. And he thinks something needs to change on a societal level if people are to live more fulfilling lives. His book is an attempt to put his finger on what that something might be. David was in London earlier this week and came to CapEx's offices to talk about The Second Mountain. I started by asking him about the personal crisis that serves as the book's starting point.
David Brooks, I think for our listeners to understand this book properly, we need to start with a sort of personal bit, because the starting point is something in your own life that you then have sort of made a broader point out of. So maybe yeah. Perhaps sort of fill the listener in on that side of things.
In the first version of the book, there was none of me in it.
Yeah, well, this is me being very English, by the way. Yeah. Talking about my feelings, feelings very bad.
You're right, no, it's the same. I was grew up in a very Anglophilic culture, stiff upper lip, don't talk about this stuff. But it is sort of the basis. You know, I've had an amazing, fortunate career. So my mentor was William F. Buckley, and then he set me off and sent me to the Wall Street Journal editorial page and to the Weekly Standard and New Yorker, New York Times now. And so I've just had way more career success than I ever thought I had. But I think I felt for some of the lies of the culture, lies which are very individualistic, that life's an individual journey, and some that are meritocratic, that you can succeed your way to happiness. And I think what success has done is given me the ability to not feel ashamed, this sort of shame I feel if I were felt myself a failure professionally, but it hasn't given any positive benefit. And so around 2013, I fell into what you would call a social valley. My marriage had ended, my kids had gone away to college, and I've always been conservative, but not the kind of conservative that was rising in the Republican Party, mm-hmm. which was a more populist, and I'm more Burkean, I guess. So a lot of those friendships failed away. And so I spent a year or two just in the valley of solitude, and based on a life of some bad values, like just not communicating well, not being relational enough, being too quick. And as I was doing that, a lot of people in the U.S. and in the U.K. as well were falling into a valley of social disconnection, of alienation. In America, the suicide rate has risen by 30%. In the last 30 years, the teenage suicide rate is up by 70%. So what was happening to me was happening to a lot of people. And it turned out for the last 6 years, I've been trying to say, how do you pull yourself out of a valley? And now the question is, how do we pull our nations out of valleys?
And this is where you get the two mountains metaphor, which through the book, the first mountain is the sort of professional success you search for. And the second one is a more moral moral success.
It's really just a metaphor for two value systems. Mm-hmm. And one value system is an individualistic value system. I'm free to be myself. I don't want any restraints on me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a value system we adopted really in the early 60s as a way to get out of the overly confining culture of the 1950s. And it was necessary over time to loosen up American society, and it had a right-wing version, which was about economic freedom, and it had a left-wing version, which was about lifestyle freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Live any way you want. And I think we've taken those to the extreme. And so now we have to find some way to culturally get back to the spot where we can commit to each other and strengthen the bonds between people.
And one of the things at the heart of this is, which you think is built on lots of lies, basically, is meritocracy, which in political terms is a kind of cross-party thing. I mean, everyone agrees that it's a good thing and pledges their support to it. But what is it about that that you think has been so damaging?
Yeah, I think we've underestimated the moral and cultural damage the meritocracy has done. And so one of the lies of the meritocracy is you can earn your way to happiness, that career success leads to fulfillment. Another lie of the meritocracy is you're not a soul to be saved, you're a set of skills to be maximized. And so it's sort of a shrinkage of the self, a moral numbing of the self. There's a lot of conditional love in the meritocracy. I teach at Yale, which is a meritocratic institution par excellence. And a lot of the kids there, their parents love them all the time, but they show love when the kid does something they think will lead to career success. And the parents withdraw love when the kid does something they think will not lead to career success. And so those kids, the most important relationship in their life is fragile. They feel they have to earn their parents' love by performing really well. And that's just a horrible way to live. And then the final and most corrosive view of the meritocracy is that people who've succeeded or are smarter are somehow worth more than others. And this is something people in society who are not part of the meritocratic elite feel and are resentful and alienated about and angry. And that's why we have populist uprisings, because they feel invisible and looked down upon. And so to me, the meritocracy is necessary. We're always going to have a meritocracy. But the culture of the meritocracy has been corrosive in a lot of different ways.
Of course, I guess the sort of absurd extreme of this is the college admission scandal, which kind of laid a lot of this bare in America. What do you think that told people about all of this?
Yeah, just the insane status orientation. I mean, we put our kids through the university admissions process at age 15, and that teaches them that status and achievement are at the core of life. And, you know, we look back on sort of Victorian or medieval novels and plays where people made these fine social distinctions between one family and another, which was more prestigious.
Mm.
Well, they were as nothing compared to the fine distinctions we in the U.S. make between Princeton and Williams.
Mm-hmm.
All these excellent schools, which we have these fine, like one of them gets ranked slightly higher than the other. And so people will pay millions of dollars to get into the one ranked slightly higher than the other. And it's become the way we... It's another lie of the meritocracy is that you could get prestigious, you can win prestige by attaching yourself to prestigious brands.
Mm.
And Yale and Harvard are a brand, Princeton's a brand, Oxford, Cambridge are brands in the same way that, Gucci's a brand. I have a friend who was at a job interview and he turned the question around on his questioner and he asked her at the end of the interview, what would you do if you weren't afraid? And that's a very good question to ask people. And she burst out crying because she wouldn't be doing HR at that company, but she's too afraid to quit.
Mm-hmm.
And so I now ask that question to my Yale students, and every time I ask it of a group of, say, 24, there's two or three who say I'd leave Yale. It's not the right school for them, but they don't want to give up the brand.
Mm.
And so a lot of people become imprisoned by the brands.
Mm. One of the things I sort of found myself thinking reading the book is the question of, you know, are you describing a new or an old problem? I mean, and maybe that's too black and white way of putting it. In other words, you're describing a kind of first world problem that, you know, is a product of the fabulous, you know, wealth and technological innovation and so on that we enjoy as a society. Or are you describing something that's, you know, deeply, you know, we're all humans always have been susceptible to and always will be susceptible to? And you know, how do you sort of where do you sort of sit on that spectrum?
Yeah, first, I don't think it's a first world problem. I think finding meaning and spiritual sustenance in life is a universal human problem.
Okay,
and so I've been to a lot of very poor parts of the world, and I've never met anybody who didn't want to have a meaningful life with good relationships. So it's foundational, not just a luxury you get after food and water. But it's I think it's a perpetual problem, especially for those of us, frankly, in English North America. We're just less communal than most other cultures. And it's reflected in good ways, I would say, in our economy, but also in bad ways. We don't have the same sort of communal nature that is assumed in Africa, in Latin America, and in Japan, say. And so we, in the U.S., and I think here too, we buy kids this book called Oh, the Places You'll Go by Dr. Seuss.
Oh, yeah.
And it's about a young kid leading a life from school all the way up to success. But if you actually look at the book, the lesson is that life is an individual journey. He's got no friends and no attachments, no relations. Mm-hmm. And I just ran into a sociologist at Stanford, I think, who said she hands that book to immigrant kids, immigrants to the U.S., and they hate that book because it doesn't reflect their experience. Like, how do you go by when you have no attachments?
Yeah.
But that's sort of the subtle assumption of our culture, that mm-hmm. life is an individual journey.
And that's another of the sort of lies, isn't it, that life is a sort of collection of experiences.
Which is, Kierkegaard described this. Kierkegaard weirdly anticipated Instagram.
Yeah.
Because he had this concept called the aesthetic life, where you measure your life by whether it's by aesthetic criteria, is it pleasurable or painful? And he said, well, that's great for a little while, but eventually you want your life to add up to something. And then you can't use aesthetic criteria to measure that. And so, my hope is that we'll move away from a life that's hyper-individualized and not revert, which is what we're doing right now, to tribe. Mm. Tribe is a way to form community, but it's a very ugly way to form community. It's based on mutual hatred. And in the book, I talk about four commitments. And a lot of the book has really grown out of my teaching at school, where my students, in the 15 or 20 years after graduation, are going to make four big commitments in their lives, most of them, to a spouse and family, to a vocation, to a philosophy and faith, and to a community. And how the fulfillment of our lives depends on how smartly they choose those who to marry, what vocation to go into, where to live, what to believe, and then how well they execute on those commitments. So a lot of the book is just saying, here's how to do commitments well.
And what do we get? What do we get wrong about commitments, and how we make them?
Well, we tend not to make them. Want to think, oh, I'm going to keep my options open. And then once you, my view is don't keep your options open. You got to commit to something. And a lot of the advice I give is just super practical. Like, how do you find out what your vocation is? That's often a very aesthetic decision. What do you feel is beautiful? Mm. And so I tell the story of the scientist E.O. Wilson, who when he was seven, his parents were divorcing. They sent him off to some family he didn't know to live on the ocean front in Florida. And he discovered fish. Jellyfish, he'd never heard of a jellyfish before. He was astounded by it. He saw a stingray, and he was immediately seized by the desire to know this world, and he fell in love with the world, just fell at home there. And often we choose our vacations just because we have an aesthetic sense of feeling at home. My daughter plays ice hockey, and she started at 5, and she's now 25, and she teaches ice hockey. She just feels at home at a rink. A painter was once asked, why'd you become a painter? And she just said, I love the smell of paint. There's just some aesthetic sense, and for me it was writing. I read Paddington the Bear when I was 7, and have been reading ever since. And then how do you stick with your commitments? Some of that is just how to do relationship well. And so basically I culled a lot of the best advice I could find from anywhere and threw it in this book. Mm-hmm. So for example, in marriage, how do you do the marriage commitment well? One of the things, some of it is just practical advice that, they say if you're married you should never go to bed mad. But sometimes you should just go to bed. You're tired, go to bed, make waffles, and you'll feel happier in the morning. Another piece of advice I read somewhere and pass along is that if you're a wife and you're going to bitch to somebody about your husband's bad behavior, bitch to his mom and not yours, because his mom will forgive him and yours never will. So there's just like living out relationally is actually a very day-to-day practical business.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
One of the interesting things about the, on the kind of national level, is the fact, I think, that I would say basically everyone recognizes this problem in some way, shape, or form. So I you know, CapEx is a, with the website I edit is a sort of pro-market, fairly individualistic, ideologically outfit. I probably know, I'm on first name terms with probably everyone in Britain who thinks we need more individualism and more hyper-individualism. And the rest of the country disagrees with it, with those people I know. So what do you kind of, you know, how do you kind of make sense of that, that there's this problem that people see? You know, no one ever would mention the word community in anything other than a positive sense, right? So how do you make the step from that recognition of the problem to actually improving the situation, as which you think has gone wrong somehow?
Well, so, you know, I grew up, you know, Milton Friedman was my mentor. I grew up in Wall Street Journal editorial page. I have retained a healthy appreciation for free markets. But I do think it's useful to have a culture that counterbalances some of the, some of that. And so the market is always going to drive us to be competitive, to be fast, to be productive, and to be achievement oriented and to be ambitious. And but to actually have a healthy market, it relies on a bed of social relationships, a bed of trust. And there's a great deal of research on this, that high trust societies have better markets. Because you can basically take somebody at their word when you're doing a contract with them. And but those deals have to be formed at the foundational level of the market, which is the level of social trust and social cohesion. And I don't, T.S. Eliot once said, one of the great illusions of life is that you can produce a system so well structured that people don't have to be good. And I think that is a lie, that people have to be good. Even in, for the market to work, you have to have a moral cohesion to society. For politics to work without being a complete dog-eat-dog, you have to have some moral cohesion. And so, you know, I've a lot of my heroes, there was a guy named Michael Novak who probably died 10 or 15 years ago, who would write about capitalism, but write about the social structure that you need to surround capitalism. And so my problem, my argument would be that social cohesion has fallen away. And the systems of care have fallen away. And we had, the Enlightenment was very individualistic. It was mostly written by men like John Locke and Jean-Paul Rousseau, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who didn't have children. And probably did not even see the systems of care the women around them were constructing and did not appreciate it. And so I do think you need the market plus a social cohesion that pushes against the market, or else we just become Randian figures, and I'm not in favor of being a Randian figure.
But equally, you're not making a sort of conventionally left-wing point, because you're not saying that this is a, you're not calling for an alternative economic system, certainly, and nor are you calling for sort of the state to come in and necessarily provide something that you know, isn't there. And you're asking for a sort of bottom-up solution.
And you know, somebody made the good point that the state can provide services, but it can't provide care. It can't actually do relationships. That's up to neighbors, family members, friends, community. But that system of care has to be in place. And so I, this is much more about shifting culture than it is about, you know, going back to socialism. And, you know, I'm now surrounded by people in the U.S. who want to go back to socialism, as I guess you are here.
And not in this building, I have
to
say.
Not in this building, no. Well, this is Keith Joseph's
more,
thing.
More generally.
Having already fought this battle once. Somebody said, a guy named Paul Weaver said, the problem with the younger generation is they haven't read the minutes to the last meeting. And so I feel we already had this argument. We're about to have it again. And I, you know,
but do you see a connection between what you're writing about and this burgeoning left wing?
Yeah, I do. I think, I mean, in my view, society has left a lot of people naked and alone, and they want to find bonds. And those bonds can sometimes form for some people in tribal identity, mm-hmm. white ethnicity in the U.S., or rural, whatever, Trumpian, that's an identity. And I think it's an unattractive form of community, but it is some form of bonding. And then on the left, I think the desire for community comes into sort of state-centered economic community. Mm-hmm. And I think socialism, the reason it has perpetual appeal is that it does seem to offer a solution to the problem of fragmentation. And for people who are lonely, it seems to offer a compassionate cause they can devote their lives to. So it's like, you know, it is a secular religion, and this has been analyzed down through the centuries, and there's a reason it never goes away.
Yeah. You mentioned tribalism versus community. What's the obviously you describe the Trump phenomenon as a tribal one. Right. What's the distinction between, what are the features of tribalism that good community doesn't have?
Community is based on mutual affection for a town or a cause or a nation. Tribalism is based on common animosities. We both dislike the same group of people. Mm-hmm. And so community is built out an abundance mentality. There's plenty for us all to go around. I can have my community, you can have yours, and we can create enough so there'll be plenty. Tribalism, not only based on mutual hostility, it's also based on a scarcity mentality. Mm. There's not enough. It's a zero-sum struggle for resources between groups. And so distrust is the worldview. It's always about erecting barriers, building walls. And so tribalism seems like community, but it's the negative mirror image of it. And it's unfortunately where people go first, because it's just easy to arouse people through fear. Psychologists have a saying that the hardest thing to cure is the patient's attempt to self-cure. And tribalism is our attempt to self-cure for loneliness. And unfortunately, it's the one of the dominating ethoses of our world, starting Viktor Orban or wherever mm-hmm. you want to go, Putin, and now Trump.
Mm-hmm. But your book some of this is very gloomy, and you describe you list the depressing statistics about suicide and loneliness in America. But equally, it's not quite as pessimistic a book as that might make it sound. Right. I mean, most nonfiction books are like, sell by being, here is why the end is, the world is ending, and here's how we can stop it. Yeah. But you're actually a bit more upbeat than that.
Yeah, no, if you go through the history of nonfiction books and look at the time when they were written, the end is always coming.
And it never arrives.
The people in my business or our business are way overly pessimistic. Mm-hmm. And the book is called The Second Mountain because after the Valley of Isolation, it's an attempt to describe a better way to live, which a lot of people then go on to do. And then it's just in terms on the societal level, people aren't genius. They figure stuff out. And cultures shift, and they shift in response to the problems of the mm-hmm. moment. And so we moved toward a much more individualistic culture in the 60s and the 80s because we needed to. The economy was stagnant. The culture was boring. People were crushed by conformity. And so we shifted, and that was the right thing to do at the time. Now we've sort of run out the string on that, and it's time to shift to something else. And those moments of shift, transitional moments, can be very bumpy. Like 1968 or 69 was a transitional moment, 1848. There are times when countries all around the world suffer from similar problems. And now we're in another transitional moment, and we're also sort of wrestling with populism. We're wrestling with the rise of socialism, ethnic nationalism. And it's all the same sort of transition. And I'm just hoping we don't transition to Viktor Orban, we transition to something, mm-hmm. A community that's nicer.
And do you see much evidence of Americans, rising to that challenge? I mean, we haven't talked about some of the people in your book who you sort of hold up as examples of people who have successfully climbed the second mountain and have a sort of joy to their existence.
I call them weavers because they are weavers of relationship and weavers of community, and they're just geniuses at relationship. And some of them are entrepreneurs and business people who live for others, some who have made a fortune and then devote their lives to healthcare, or I met a guy who was a banker then devoted the rest of his life to helping guys coming out of jail. But a lot of them are in nonprofits, and some of them have done amazing things with their lives. There's a kid I know in D.C. whose dad had an affair when he was 9 with a stripper, and the stripper killed him. So my friend Darius was left without a dad, and now he runs a football program for young men. So they'll have father figures in their lives. And there are people, wherever you look, who are taking in the lonely and the homeless and giving them relationship. Hmm. And some of their work is completely amazing. And we're not all going to do that, because it's just, you know, I have a friend who she has 40 people, 40 young kids living with her, or eating with her. And that's just heroic level of selfless love. And I met a woman in Chicago who has 75 kids come to her little apartment to do their homework every afternoon because they have no place else to go. But if we could all do a little thing, be the, sort of the captain of our block, be an aggressive friend. I have a friend who had very close friends at university and he wanted to make sure he kept them through life. So what they did, they got together 15 of their best friends and they created a giving circle. They throw money into a pot every year, and every year they take 3 days off just to be with each other to decide where they give it away. Mm-hmm. And the giving is nice, but it's not really the point. The mm-hmm. point is getting them together for 3 or 4 days every mm-hmm. year so they can lead their whole lives together. And so there are just a lot of technologies for convening human beings together. Mm-hmm. And the people I admire are pretty aggressive in their friendships.
But the crucial thing about this is that it's not a question of... you know, doing this to feel good about yourself, right? There's a distinction here to be drawn between between essentially a fundamentally sort of selfish, I guess, approach yeah. to it and something which is giving yourself over to something yeah. bigger or someone else. Right. Or
yeah, well, the whole basis for the book is everybody says you should serve a cause larger than self, but nobody tells you how. So this book is supposed to be show you exactly how people do that. And, you know, I do think we all are motivated to want to feel we're doing some good in the world. If we don't have that sense of feeling, life falls apart pretty quickly.
That was David Brooks on The Second Mountain. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.